The Accidental Entrepreneur is produced by Beinhacker Law and brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors. One of One Productions, the New Jersey-based podcast studio that produces and edits both audio and video podcasts. They sell equipment for the average podcaster and have even created a guesting kit exclusively for our listeners. North Authentic, the conscious hair care marketplace offering the cleanest brands from around the world. The Healthy Place, the e-commerce site with thousands of supplements to help you live a healthier life, along with natural solutions for chronic pain, stress, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, and much, much more. And be sure to support the podcast by ordering some logo merchandise from our online store. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
You can never just sit on you're on the present, you know, things are always evolving and you always need to troubleshoot. So
right.
I had to get an angel investor in 2008, finally, because I had pushed back for years, a lot of opportunities to get an investor on board. And I didn't want to, because for me, it was like somebody that's going to tell me what to do.
Right. You know? Lose some control and stuff. Sure.
Well, you know, it's like, you know, they have a right to say what they think I should do. And that to me was like, oh man.
Right.
So, but I finally found somebody that was well off, so would not be worried about his pennies and always like be on my back.
So you found somebody who you were more comfortable with.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that person was really wanting to invest. So finally, you know, I think it was a very positive situation for both parties, and it took like 8 months before I said yes, and you know, it was well negotiated and it worked out well, you know.
Yeah.
And it was right before the crash of 2008. Well,
I know. It was the same up there, right? Same up in Canada as it was here. Yeah.
So you
know,
luckily,
but there's another lesson there though. Yeah. Maybe bringing on an investor is a good thing, but don't jump into it. Don't say, wow, this person's going to save me and bring in all kinds of money, because you may regret it if you don't pick the right partner who supports you in the right way.
Yeah.
So, and you were reluctant about it, and he finally convinced you, or she, I don't know who it is.
Yeah, it's a he.
So 2008, like in the United States, the housing market completely collapses because all this ridiculousness going on Wall Street, and you're like right in the middle of it, right?
No, I'm sitting on my money.
Oh, good.
I have
it.
It's in my bank account, and I'm really happy.
Good. It's not in your house, right? Or a piece of real estate. Okay.
Yeah. No. And you know what? That's another important piece of advice. Is I sat on that money. I used it for leverage for debt.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hi, I'm Geneviève Gagnon, president and founder of a company called La Fourmi Bionique, based out of Montreal, and we manufacture gourmet artisanal breakfast cereal and snacks using organic ingredients. And I'm glad to be here sharing my story with you today.
All right, Geneviève, thanks so much. I know it took us a while to get together, but I was introduced to you by, who introduced us?
Jillian.
Yes, Jillian in London. Yeah. I was thinking Jillian, Geraldine. Okay, it was definitely Jillian because she used to live in Canada, right?
Yes.
That's you know her from those days?
Yes.
Got it. Well, I think it's really interesting because I love to have guests on that are, you know, producing products and in the whole supply chain, because it's different than when you have a service. It's just a different, you know, kind of business. You have to produce it, you have to manufacture it, and you got employees. So, but I'd like to start though with your background. you know, where you're from, where you grew up, what your training was. I don't know where you went to university, and then how you got, and then we'll work our way up to how you got into the food business and when you launched the company. And then we can talk all about that stuff. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay. It's all yours. Let's go.
All right. So I'm born and bred Quebecer. So born in Quebec, Canada. And I've lived most of my life in Montreal. I went to school to start in psychology, did my bachelor in psychology.
Okay.
Didn't know what I wanted to do. So that just seemed like, okay, well, I'll just go hang out there.
Right. Sure.
And then I went to do a bachelor in public relations, which is like business communications. And I did that in 2 years because I got some courses credited. And so I hurried up and got out of the program and went to work early 20s and worked in communications in different fields. So in the public sector, and private sector event management. And managing
corporations, like you were in-house doing their events, doing their PR.
Yeah. Okay. Public affairs at a beer company. And I worked also as an independent consultant with a little firm. I was Santa Claus's press agent. Very, very popular guy.
I'm sure. That was only in Canada, though, right? Right.
Yeah, he lives closer to us than to you guys, right?
Exactly.
And also, I got to do a lot of event management when I worked for a nonprofit organization, and that was all over the northeastern part of Canada. So I quickly, you know, got the chance to try the different areas of my field and realized that I was looking forward to retiring quite young. So it was like, you know, why didn't the shoe fit? You know, everything that I tried, it never felt like the right shoes for me. And, you know, there was something so constricting about the job descriptions. And it was always like, you know, such specific things. And, you know, basically when you're on the work market, it's like you'll get the job that you're hired to do. And it's not you that decides what you're going to do. And you pretty much need to conform to what your colleagues and your boss want you to do.
Right. It's not a lot of creativity.
And I just really didn't fit into that mold. And I didn't understand why. And finally, you know, I was like, what's my problem? You know, I was a high achiever in school, but yet in the work field, it was just not like, you know, I was never losing my job or anything, but it just.
No, like, but you weren't that motivated, right? Yeah, it didn't get you excited to go to work in the morning. A lot of people have that problem, and a lot of people don't do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes I find there's some form of courage in that because, you know, it's like you have the courage to get up and go to work every day, although you don't like your job. Like I would never have had that courage, you know?
Right.
So that pushed me to really get out of my comfort zone and question myself about the fact that I might be an entrepreneur. And I kind of like realized that it was probably in my genes because both my grandfathers were entrepreneurs. Okay. And so was my father. He owned the corner store. All my youth, you know, was around that little business where we all worked at the convenience store.
Like a general store, convenience store around the corner in the neighborhood?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like a 7-Eleven, you know, for
you guys. Sure.
And he was also a partner in a supermarket with other partners. So, I mean, I would like be with my sister and we would be alone in the big supermarket and just racing our carts and putting cereal in our carts while my father was dealing with serious business and he had, you know, some problems, but I didn't know it back then.
Right.
There's always a lot of smoke in the office. You know, they were smoking a lot of cigarettes.
In those days, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, all this to say, I kind of like, you know, got to thinking that I probably was part of who I was. And then it's like, okay, where do we go from here?
Right. What are you going to do? You can make beer. I mean, you know, what other industries were you working for? It was a nonprofit. There was the beer industry. So you just like had a blank piece of paper, right? What am I going to do?
Well, I could have become a consultant.
Yeah.
But there was no way that I would have felt after like, 5 years in the field that I was competent enough to start offering my services.
Yeah, where you're not reporting to anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like I really by far didn't have the confidence. So I wanted to hide behind a product.
Okay, that's a way of looking at it, I guess.
Yeah, it's less, you know, the rejection is less personal, you know.
Right, they're so, just rejecting the product instead of you.
Exactly.
Right.
And
I never really looked at it that way. That's a good comment. Yeah.
And at the same time, there was also the opportunity of when you do a certain type of business,
yeah,
that you can it can outgrow your personal time and resources. So if you're a consultant, you're working hard to generate right. your salary. But if you're manufacturing a product, then the product can get manufactured while you're not working.
Right. It's much harder to be independent from the business if you're a consultant, because it's really just you, right? People yeah. want you. They're not hiring your associates with the yeah. product. They don't care as much. They're buying the product.
Yeah. And I see it a lot with other people around me who are consultants and they're still in the field and they've been in it a long time. They yeah. work crazy schedules.
Yeah. You know, they're just solopreneurs.
They have to jump in, you know, to the files, yeah. you know, of their employees, and then right. clients are asking for them. And so they're really prisoners of their businesses. And I yeah. didn't want that. And I saw my father be a prisoner of his business, which was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And he always need to be there and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the employees would be calling home any time of day or night, like to either say they're not showing up, there was a holdup, you know, there's no more gas, there's no more change in the cash, you know, like, so the,
right.
it was very, you know, like overwhelming, and we can never leave on vacation more than a few days. And, you know, I didn't want that.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
And so
you had that experience though, to know that a lot yeah. of people don't realize, and they get involved in a business and mm-hmm. they become a slave to the business. Like you said, yeah. they can't go away. I mean, your dad had one store, so he couldn't hire like a manager, because then he wouldn't make enough money probably
exactly.
to pay the manager. So he had to be the person that dealt with everything.
Yeah. And I didn't have that, you know, false misconception that most people have, that entrepreneurs are necessarily all wealthy.
Right.
So I had realistic expectations of what I wanted for myself, but because, you know, my father was not wealthy, and yet he worked really hard.
Yeah. There's no correlation.
Yeah. Yeah.
There isn't. And a lot of entrepreneurs are just poor. Their business is just mm-hmm. a lifestyle business. It supports their yeah. lifestyle. But if they stop whatever they're doing, the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah.
It's definitely a myth and a misunderstanding about entrepreneurship. I think I agree with you.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I've seen unhappy entrepreneurs in my life, you know,
right.
like, you know, in different stages of my life. And, you know, so, yeah, I had some models to not
right.
copy.
Don't let this happen to you like a thing.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah,
exactly. So basically got thinking about things that most people, you know, don't figure out until later in life. And it's like, what's yeah. my passion? You know, because you're just going through the motions. You're going to school because you have to go to school and you're getting your degrees. And,
yeah.
you know, you don't really have the time to think about, like, what's my essence? What really drives me? What makes
right.
me happy? You know, like, that's a luxury, right? Asking those questions.
It is. I know. I think we should all be given the opportunity to do that before we go to college and kind of say, mm-hmm. okay, what path do I want to go down? And maybe you will change it anyway. But I think you're right. A lot of kids in Canada, in the United States, we just, you know, we're raised in relatively, you know, well-to-do families. We're all, you know, we have opportunities. These are first world problems, right? And we just don't know, right? We go to high school, you graduate high school, you go to college, like, you, nobody ever told you any different. And then you find yourself out of college, you're like, what am I doing with my life? And it's definitely difficult. Yes, you know, and you have a general major, psychology, marketing, whatever. And then what do you do? So
yeah, and you don't necessarily get to choose, eh? Because your marks decide which programs you can enter.
Right.
And then you have to be really strong in certain programs to be able to go further. So, you know, you're not choosing necessarily that much in your life, you know? I wanted to be a doctor, you know, just
the
way. All my life, I wanted to be a doctor until I went to study to college. And then I realized that it was really tough, like the level of science. And I was like,
yeah.
oh man, I can't do this. It's too tough.
I think a lot of kids do that. They get there and they're like, this is difficult. Of course it's difficult, but yeah.
And then I was also turned off by the actual career, because I was babysitting for the baby of two doctors, specialists. They were never home.
Never home, no. Yeah. You're a professional in your sleep because people really need you then, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't respond and you're a specialist or something, there could be a big problem. It's not like in law where I could deal with them tomorrow or whatever you're doing. It becomes life or death sometimes. And it's, look, my son wanted to be going to medicine. 2 weeks into college, he dropped that. He was like, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to do this. My daughter wants to go into medicine. She's in her first 2 months of school as a freshman. And so far, she's still sticking with it. So we'll see what happens with that. But I think you're right. Look, everything always looks more glamorous and better from the outside until you get in. And you really have to like what you do on the hardest days. Because there will always be hard days in everything you do. But yeah, you have a lot of insight. I think a lot that people don't have.
You know, it's crazy schedules, let me tell you that. And so basically, you know, I didn't want to become a slave to anything. Like I really wanted my full freedom. And you'll be happy to fast forward 20 years later to say, finally, right, did you reach your objectives? But all this to say that, you know, I realized I was passionate about food and the thing that really, you know, made me happy and, you know, excited me and, you know, drew me in was like food and seeing my grandmother cook and going to the restaurant and eating gourmet food. And I also was working out a lot at that time in my life where I realized a relationship between what I was eating and how I was feeling and the level of energy. So it got me very in tune to, you know, I would be craving the things that my body needed. I was completely in tune to that. So I thought it was really interesting to see, you know, what was offered in the stores compared to what my body seemed to be craving. And at this time, okay, I played restaurant for a year while keeping my day job. I did that once a month with my boyfriend of the time. And the restaurant was called La Fumée Bien-Aimée. So that was the first venture of like, let's see, you know, try this out.
So you said once a month, what, you opened the restaurant once a month?
Well, you know what? It was an underground restaurant in my apartment.
Oh, it was like a secret, like special. Yeah. You got to know somebody to get in and taste Genevieve's food. So that probably rose demand a lot.
Yeah. Well, it was always full house and it was
once a month, right? You couldn't get in.
100% organic. And people had to decide what they wanted from the menu before they showed up. So I already, you know, had prepared everything.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend was the waiter.
It's like a secret eating club.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I like that.
And it had tables all over, you know, we would remove all the furniture, push it in one room, and then there would matching cloths. And it was like, you know, it was really like looking a little, like a restaurant.
Like
it
a pop-up. Like,
yeah, exactly.
This was your apartment?
Yeah. And it was in the most trendy neighborhood of Montreal. It's the restaurant neighborhood. And it was in the middle of that, you know, so it was a perfect location as well, you know. Yeah.
There's a restaurant in New York City. It's like, I think it's called La Esquina. It's a Mexican restaurant or Spanish or something. Anyway, you go in the restaurant, it looks like a total dump and you won't want to eat there. And but you have to know somebody and they take you through a back door and downstairs. And there's this huge, beautiful restaurant that you can't get in unless you know somebody and you have a connection. So it was like secret. I like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a good way to test things, right? Because you're not taking a lot of risk. Yeah. You're not buying, leasing a place, you know. Did the health department know about it?
No.
Well, it's over now, so it doesn't matter.
Clandestine.
Right. I like that. Yeah.
And so basically I did try the granola in one of these events and it was a brunch event and it was a huge success. And I kept doing it for me and my boyfriend at home. And every time that we would have the granola in the pantry, we would kill it like it was cookies, you know.
This was making your own granola, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was like the granola was, it took a lot of ingredients. It took a lot of time, but it was like nothing I had ever tasted before. It was the most delicious thing ever. And there was nothing in the store.
Granola is like you're putting like oats and grains and maybe dried fruits and nuts and all those types of things to come up with different recipes, right? It's basically what it is. Honey, I don't know, some agent to bond it together. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. In your kitchen, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I got really tired of the restaurant routine of the it lasted a year and every time it was so stressful, it was so tiresome. And I had two seatings, one at 6, one at 9. I had to do the dishes by hand in between. There was 20 people at a time. And I was like, you know, this is tough. I don't have any training in this and I don't see how I'm going to make any money. There were no grants offered for this type of business.
Right.
And my boyfriend at the time said, why don't you launch the granola product instead?
Good idea.
And my business plan was already developed, you know, based on going towards the organic trend. And then I just tweaked it towards the cereal market. And I did a study that showed that the adult cereal market was really positioned to grow, and that all the people that were raised on cereals were going to be looking towards healthier options. And there was like all these statistics that were really supporting this move towards the cereal product. And so basically for a year, I left my day job. And for a year, I
did
testing recipes with some people that were part of the restaurant experience, and they would be giving me their comments. I would be compiling. It was very data oriented. Yeah. And I just full time every day put my apron on, did recipes every day. And then I started making some and selling it. Yeah. And then I went into this program for entrepreneurs and finalized my business plan and started making it a different caterers where they would rent out their kitchen to me for free.
You know, I gotta stop you for a second to make a comment, because this is a really good lesson for all the people that listen and the message that I'm trying to get across. A lot of people start off in business and they're all excited, right? And they go out and they buy huge amounts of ingredients and they make all this stuff. And then they find out that nobody wants the product. And you really, really, really tested what you were doing. You tested the concept of being in the restaurant business, although it probably was exhausting doing a restaurant like that, right? Because if you had a restaurant that was equipped, it wouldn't be so difficult, but you would be doing it every day, you know? So doing it once a month was like having a production, right? It was like you had to get ready and it was difficult. So, but you learned that. You learned what people liked and what they didn't like. And then with the granola, you tested and tested and tested. You wrote a business plan. You tested the market. You did the research. And I think a lot of people, like, they overlook the value of that. And you make a lot of mistakes that are very costly when you can test things as you go and find ways to do it and do it, like you said, bootstrap it and do it to start before you go hire a co-packer and a manufacturing facility. And you said now you're finding commercial ways to do it, not by renting a kitchen full time, but by sharing it. And I think a lot of people should learn from the fact that you can, you know, take little baby steps along the way and figure the path, because it's not a straight path from start to success. So I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, and then you're in a program and now you're really working your business plan. I mean, you're really preparing yourself for success. Doesn't guarantee it, right? But it increased your chance of success by probably 10 or 20 fold than if somebody just making granola out of their kitchen, putting it in a bag and selling it at a flea market. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And people can learn from your experience.
Well, I think that you need to be patient, you know, and you see my boyfriend at the time was with me in this adventure. And then he dropped out because he's like, when are we going to start making money? You know? And I said, well, it's not now.
You know, it takes a while.
Yeah. And so, you know, since I was like, you know, still young, you know, I didn't have that much of a high level
responsibility,
of
cost of living, you know? Right.
Yeah. But at the same time, I had no collateral. And, you know, so basically I had to, you know, go from grant to grant because I won these prizes and I got
you
these
did.
Grants.
Okay. Yeah, that helped you go.
The strength of my business plan really, you know, proved to be useful. You know, all the efforts I had put in gave a lot of credibility.
Right. That plan, right, for the grant. You had to submit it with the grant. And exactly. Okay. Okay. So people programs. Should learn that too.
And then basically, you know, after 2 years of like producing it, like part-time and being at a certain threshold of revenue, then I really want to have my own facility because it was tough, you know, to share the kitchen. And it was like, you know, depressing schedules and Saturday
you can't do
night,
that long-term. And, you know, do it long-term. No, not if you want to be successful. Yeah.
It was painful. Yeah. To be honest,
right.
You know,
exhausting, right?
Yeah. You know, like, you know, but the thing is for me, failure was not an option because you know what? I didn't want to go back to the job market.
Right.
So this had to work. So I was really ready to do all the compromises, but now looking back, I wouldn't do it again. You know, don't ask
me. Well, now, cause you're on the other side of the mountain. So here, right. Yeah, well, okay, that's for someone else to do in their business. Yeah. You did that. Yeah. I agree. Yeah, it's just, you know, failure doesn't have to be an option, but going backwards doesn't have to be an option either. Yeah. You figure a way to keep going forward. Okay, great. This is a great story.
And then, so basically in 2006, I got my first, my first facility. I got my facility and it's still
that you could use during business hours 7 days a week if you wanted to, whenever you wanted to. Okay.
Yeah. And it was too big for me at the time, which made it tough because it was tough because you want to like be able to grow into it. You don't want it to be too small too quickly, but at the same time it was hard to lease anything that was very small.
Yeah,
so
it's hard.
It was almost 4,000 square feet. And
that's big.
And it took me a few years to be able to
grow into it.
Yeah, exactly. And that my employees would be working full time and that I would be able to, you know.
And like, you had to balance the cost of the space and you had to pay for it, right? So, and you couldn't sublet it. There was no way to kind of share the space at that time with anybody?
No, because, you know, like a food manufacturing plant is pretty hefty investment, you know, like, you know, because you got the equipment, the ventilation and, you know, and you want it to be clean. But I had subletted it a little bit to somebody that was making bars, but it was like, you know, it was change.
Yeah, it didn't really help.
Yeah. So basically, you know, so those were a couple of tough years. And then, you know, we toughed it out. We grew the sales. I mean, I learned to juggle with money and be extremely, you know, cost efficient and savvy with the traffic of my liquidity, you know, and the in and out and, you know, when to mail the check. And, you know, it was a
cash
very
flow.
Tight operation. You know,
right.
Very tight.
Well, but a lot of people don't learn that either. They don't learn the cash management side of their business and they get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, they have some cash up front and cash flow hides a lot of things. Like when you have money coming in the door and going out the door, you don't realize you're not making any money until something happens. So it's all these things I think are good, right? Until there's no more. Well, that's what happened during the pandemic, right? People were in business. Let's use restaurants, for example, right? All of a sudden they're shut down and they realized, oh my God, I wasn't making any money running that restaurant. And I'm working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I'm exhausted. And a lot of them didn't go back to that because they didn't do their homework to look at their numbers and really determine, am I making money? And is that increasing or am I not making money? And restaurants, because it all stopped. Oops.
But you're most of the time, you're surviving for an X amount of years, right? Of an X period of years, you're surviving. And, you know, you think that you're failing until you succeed, you know, because it's so hard, you're not making money.
Right.
But when you talk to other entrepreneurs, you realize, you know, like some people that are in business over 20 years, then they'll share the war stories. You know, they won't tell you they're in trouble when they're in trouble. But once they're over the hill, and I remember this distributor that was, you know, over 20 years experience had told me, man, the first 7 years we were in business, we made no money. And I wasn't at that 7 year threshold yet, but I was not making money. And I was like, oh my God, okay, it's not me. Because I was making it really personal. I was like, man, I'm so incompetent at making money. Why am I not able to make money? You know?
Right.
But today I realize what a tough operation it is, because you got so many expenses.
Yeah.
So many expenses. And you try to anticipate
whether you sell or not, right?
Yeah. But you try to anticipate the level of expenses and revenues, but you try to anticipate. But it's never that. It never is what you're gonna project, what you're gonna tell your bankers.
Right. It always changes.
The partners. Yeah. You know, it's never what you think. And there's always like, oh, yeah, I didn't expect that. Oh, yeah, that happened. Oh, that's going to cost us money. Oh, did we lose that? Oh, we had to pay for a plane. You know, so it's like a constantly changing equation, you know.
Right.
You can never just sit on your on the present. You know, things are always evolving and you always need to troubleshoot. So I had to get an angel investor in 2008. Finally, because I had pushed back for years, a lot of opportunities to get an investor on board. And I didn't want to, because for me, it was like somebody that's going to tell me what to do.
Right. You lose some control and stuff. Sure.
Well, you know, it's like, you know, they have a right to say what they think I should do. And that to me was like, oh, man.
Right.
So, but I finally found somebody that was well off, so would not be worried about his pennies and always like be on my back.
So you found somebody who you were more comfortable with.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that person was really wanting to invest. So finally, you know, I think it was a very positive situation for both parties, and it took like 8 months before I said yes, and you know, it was well negotiated and it worked out well, you know.
Yeah.
And it was right before the crash of 2008. Well,
I know. It was the same up there, right? Same up in Canada as it was here. Yeah.
So
you know,
luckily,
but there's another lesson there though. Yeah. Maybe bringing on an investor is a good thing, but don't jump into it. Don't say, wow, this person's going to save me and bring in all kinds of money, because you may regret it if you don't pick the right partner who supports you in the right way.
Yeah.
So, and you were reluctant about it, and he finally convinced you, or she, I don't know who it is.
Yeah, it's a he. Okay.
So 2008, like in the United States, the housing market completely collapses because all this ridiculousness going on Wall Street, and you're like right in the middle of it, right?
No, I'm sitting on my money.
Oh, good.
I have okay. it. Okay. It's in my bank account, and I'm really good. Happy.
Good. It's not in your house, right? Or a piece of real estate. Okay.
Yeah. No. And you know what? That's another important piece of advice. Is I sat on that money. I used it for leverage for debt. So my investor thought that I would be coming back for cash eventually, and he would be taking more ownership. And at that time, I had given him 25% in exchange for the money. And finally, I never came back to ask for more, because I used that money to leverage debt, and it was just sitting there.
So you could balance it. And yeah.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to give up more equity.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, why aren't you spending it? I'm like, well, I'm not going to spend it. You know,
You'd learned. Yeah. Okay. Right. So don't bring in money and just spend it on the business. You might need to leverage it, and you create some debt, you manage your debt, and you keep growing your business.
Yeah.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Looking to get into podcasting? Maybe to market your business for your own enjoyment, or because you have a message you want to get out there. One of One Productions is a New Jersey-based studio just over the George Washington Bridge that caters to the booming business of podcasting. They offer a comfortable atmosphere using the latest technology available to record your podcast. And they are a full-service media company offering both audio and video production services, creating both audio and video podcasts, as well as video shorts for business and personal use. Professional audio equipment packages are available through their website for all budgets, and be sure to check out their podcast guesting kit created specially for our listeners. Care for your health. Care for the planet and look flippin' great doing it. North Authentic is a conscious hair care marketplace offering the cleanest brands from around the world. Their pro stylists curate only the most fabulous non-toxic hair products with better-for-you shampoos, serums, masks, and more that actually give you gorgeous hair without hurting your health or the planet. Hey, you've only got one life, one planet, and one glorious mane. Might as well treat them all as best you can, right? Try a 100% clean hair care routine prescribed just for you using their link in the show notes. If you don't see a big, beautiful difference in how your hair looks and feels, you can tell them they're crazy. Do you battle chronic pain, stress, anxiety, or depression? Well, if you take any supplements or you're interested in natural alternatives, you need to know about findyourhealthyplace.com. Find Your Healthy Place has thousands of supplements to help you live a better quality of life, as well as natural solutions for chronic pain, stress, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, and much, much more. Need guidance? Use their live chat feature and talk to a wellness consultant right on their website. And be sure to use our coupon code TAEPODCAST for all your purchases to get the best prices at findyourhealthyplace.com. Follow their links in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
I had to learn to live with debt and to be comfortable around debt, you know, like.
Right. Well, debt can be a good thing if it's managed properly.
Yeah.
It's that a lot of people don't manage it properly.
Yeah. Well, just because you have access to so much.
Yeah.
It's crazy, you know, like how much you have access. And then people don't realize that you should see debt as a level of spending or a level of revenue that needs to be added, or profit, you know, because yes, you're going to get 200 grand to buy your equipment, but you need to pay it back, which means you need to buy this equipment. So you need on 4 years, that's your grant time or five, well, you need to expect to make that much profit to be able to pay for that, you know, investment or needs
again,
to pay
knowing your numbers,
by generating profit.
You know your numbers and what you need to do in terms of business development to make this investment make sense, make the debt, you know, buying the equipment make sense. And you knew that. A lot of people don't know their numbers. It's a huge problem in the entrepreneurial world.
Well, it's because most people, they have one skill, right, which they hone, which is like, you know, either they're very competent at, you know, the product development or at the sales side, you know. But, you know, when you're in business, you cannot turn away from your numbers. And that's where you learn, like, people, like, they turned away from their numbers. They say, you know, not that long, but then they do bankruptcy. And they're like, I wasn't, you know, on top of my accounting. Well, you know, it's like, if you're an entrepreneur, you're responsible for your numbers and you need to own them. Otherwise, you know what? You're really relinquishing control of your business to like outer forces.
And your risk is so huge because there's so many things that could go wrong that you don't have control over. I think it's huge. I think it's probably, look, a lot of people, you know, they don't do their business plan. They don't know their markets. They do this. The biggest mistake I think entrepreneurs make is not knowing their numbers, their money coming in, their money coming out, the cost of their equipment, what they need to do from a sales standpoint. I think sometimes they're afraid, like they don't want to know the truth, really, that they need to sell 100 units to break even for this product. And they're only selling 10, you know? So I think people shy away from that stuff. Also, I think a lot of us are like right brain entrepreneurs, right? So we're very creative. We like all the creative stuff, creating the labels and the marketing. And then we go, I don't like math, you know, and they get away from it. So then fine, then you better build it into your budget and find a finance person that you trust who can help you. Don't just give it to them, but can help you with those numbers and knowing your numbers. But you're right, 100%. You have to know your numbers or you will fail. Mm-hmm. Just no question about it.
Yeah, and you can just get coached. You know, I didn't study accounting. Of course, I think that the fact that I learned along the way, it probably made it more difficult to reach my financial objectives because, you know, I had to learn by many mistakes. But at the same time, I went through a coaching process and I invested myself and I did my accounting for years until I finally let it go. So I really understood how it worked.
Right.
And it was not my favorite part. But at the same time, I slept better at night knowing exactly what the numbers were and knowing if I had money in my bank account and how long it was going to last me for. You know, it was a certain level of control that I think was healthy to have on my business, you know, and making the really good decisions based on the money that I know I have or don't have.
Right. Because this way, when you hire a bookkeeper, you hire an accountant, you know what, you know how to read the reports, you know what they mean to you.
And you know when there's mistakes.
Yeah. Right.
No, you know, when things are not working out, you can quickly monitor things. You're not blind. Like, okay, if you say it is this, okay, that's what it is, you know?
But it's not right. And you know immediately when things don't look right.
Yeah.
So you're still used to looking at it. Okay, this is a great conversation. I love this.
So basically, you know, I'm still in that same facility 20 years later, but now we have 11,000 square feet. So we
renovated. There was room to grow. There was room to grow within the building.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was very large industrial building and they've given us expansion space as the years went by.
So the 4,000 was as small as they would do at the time. Got it. Okay.
We started with just a granola line, which was a classic home style granola made with honey. And what was the signature aspect of Fourmi Bionique was adding really high-end gourmet ingredients. So I was the first to start adding fair trade organic chocolates.
Okay.
And, you know, since then, a lot have followed, the parade. And I think we were a very important trendsetter in the market because everything that we did, it got repeated or copied.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of very well-known brands that do things that were based on our trend setting that people don't know about.
Yeah.
So we're like this little, you know, niche brand, very well known in Quebec, but that has a high impact in the category. We perform well and we, you know, we've been taking some shares from the competition, you know, and really making a lot of headway in the supermarkets. We also sell to the hospitality industry. And, you know, I've been actually exporting to France since 2008. And that was just like, you know, oh, we can get a grant to go to France. Okay, sure, we're going to go to France and bring a few samples and bringing them to hotels and bringing them to stores, like the store buyers of like La Grande Épicerie, which is a really, really gourmet high-end store, and the Galerie Lafayette, they accepted to meet us and we're like, what, you know, what am I going to wear? And basically, you know, they're like, sure, when can you send me a palette? And we're like, oh man, you know, how do
really
you
that quick? Like they want, and you weren't exporting at that point, right? It was just local in Canada. Yeah.
So okay. I wasn't making money the first shipments because, I mean, like, how much is it going to cost? I don't know. Okay, let's just give them a price. But now today we're listed in you know, we have distributors and we're listed in Monop, which is a very high-end supermarket. And we still have the same listings that we had back in 2008. So our products perform well. And even there, we've trendsetted the category and we've been imitated by local companies, you know?
Fantastic.
But we're still, like, you know, holding our own in this market, you know?
So is that, you're mostly selling wholesale over there to distributors, or do you also sell directly to, you're dealing directly with the retailers? I mean, either way, you're a manufacturer, but.
Well, I used to deal directly with the retailers, and now I'm going through a distributor, which
is much easier.
Wholesales, and then he can sell through Amazon to the, right. You know, my different markets. Yeah, that's a lot better option for me.
And you use a freight forwarder from a logistics standpoint, so you don't have to, because, I mean, at first, I'm sure you're like, well, how do we ship this stuff, right?
Yeah. It was very expensive, too. But now it's part of my agreement with my current distributor that he buys it from my plant. Yeah. And just tell me where, when I need to put it, ship it and
so
where.
So he has his people or whoever he's using, pick it up at your plant, and then it's on him for the rest of it.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the only place we're really actively exporting. I mean, we've done some stuff in Spain and in Germany, but, you know, it's marginal sales compared to what we do in France. And we pretty much sell, you know, nationally in Canada now, and we're selling a little bit to the States through our online store, which has just been up since a few months now. So.
Okay, so you're just coming into the States. So you don't, there's no retail locations. Like, I can't go somewhere in New Jersey, like the Whole Foods, and buy your products. I have to buy them online in the United States so far.
Yeah, I wish I could say yes, but no, not at this point. We're not.
I'm sure you'll get there.
Well, I mean, we were in discussions with Kroger just a few months ago. But the logistics of dealing with that such a big market and having, you know, representation in that market, you know, it'll take some time before we can, you know, set that up, but we will, you know.
Yeah, you probably have to find like local smaller chains to start in different parts of the country. Like in New Jersey, there's no Kroger. It's more of a Midwest thing. So and then there's some upstate New York and they're getting gobbled up, but it's definitely a interesting market. So a lot of your food is organic, or it's all organic, clean eating, clean food, but you're also, you really have the social conscious kind of side of it, right?
Yeah.
You said fair trade.
Yeah. Well, we've always done the organic local sourcing. So we call it proximity sourcing.
Okay.
Because we've really pioneered that movement in terms of our category. So using all the cereal base is from the farmers that are near us. That we purchase, and they're all organic, and, you know, using the fair trade chocolates, which are very high end. So they're not only extremely, you know, high quality and delicious, but they're also, you know, socially responsible,
right?
You know, source ingredients.
Yeah, they're not making children pick the beans and stuff, because you can't get chocolate in North America, right? It comes only from certain parts of the world.
Yeah. And then they are manufactured by a company in Switzerland, which, you know, has these agreements in which respects the fair trade laws of, you know, the certification. So that's allocated to the actual product that we purchase.
Yeah. It's a lot to be said with that. I've just interviewed a woman who's got a company called North Authentic, and they're a clean, you know, organic beauty supply, like, so hair, you know, hair shampoos and skin creams and all that kind of stuff. And they have not only a specific list of things that they don't allow in their products, which makes it hard, obviously, to find the products they want. But it's the same thing, that they don't want to deal with companies that are, you know, have children filling jars in a basement in, you know, Malaysia or something. So I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, but there's a lot to be said for that. But at the same time, everybody's buying clothes at H&M.
Yeah. I know. I just listened to a podcast about the clothing industry, and there's some of the big players are coming out of Bangladesh or whatever, and you don't really know what's going on over there.
Yeah. But now they're trying to say it loud and clear. But I think that people are going to still want to be stylish at a low cost, you know?
Yeah. So how do you balance that, right? The people buying it don't even think about it. They're like, oh, $9.99 for a pair of pants. Well, how is that possible?
Well, it's the same consciousness that we want to bring to food and eating, you know, like, you know, what's your relationship with your body? You know, like, why are you not giving it just what it needs and the right amount and the quality that it should require? You know, right. Why are you eating all these things that are really useless nutritionally not putting your focus towards things that you would require as healthy fuel and probably, you know, positive physical image, you know? I mean, you know, you don't need to diet if you have a healthy lifestyle. And a healthy lifestyle, people think that it's extreme, you know, like you have to exercise all the time and you're cutting out meat. And, you know, like, I'm not a vegan. I'm not a, you know, I cut out nothing from my diet, you know, and I eat very fatty foods, you know, but in the end, yes, I do. And I love bacon. And
there you go. Bacon's delicious.
There's nothing that's not part of, like, I don't say I block out this food because I don't think that's the way you should eat. I think that first of all, your body will tell you what it wants. You know, if you're attuned to your appetite,
right,
it'll tell you, and your body will tell you when to stop eating. And I see these people, you know, they receive their plates and they're like, there's a lot of potatoes, you know, the portions are generous, and they're eating and they're like, they're out of breath.
Yeah.
But they don't want to waste. But isn't it the same thing? If you're eating too much food or throwing it away, you're wasting food.
Because
food you don't need, you know? Right.
Well, I think our bodies definitely sabotage us. People pick the wrong things. They pick what they think tastes good and what they get excited about. Also, look at the food industry. They hide. Yeah. There's ingredients like sugars and things like that in these products, some of the names we never even heard of that are sugars.
It's shameless. And my father's there drinking his tomato juice and he doesn't take salt in his food. I'm like, do you realize how much sodium you're drinking?
Oh my goodness.
Day? Yeah. You know, but it's like a kind of blindness. Like, people are like, you know, like, they're not, they've been told things for so long that they don't have any more critical sense about things. So to come back to the actual product is, I think that, you know, pleasure is super important. And I eat chocolate every day for breakfast. Every day.
Ooh, I want to come to your house for breakfast.
But my best-selling product, it's called the aphrodisiac. And it's like, it's not because it's an aphrodisiac. It's because it's funny, the name. You know, I like, you know, I don't take myself seriously. Like, the name of my company, it's like the bionic ant.
That's what it stands for in French?
Yeah, the bionic ant. Yeah.
I love
it. Super strong little ant, you know? And so basically, you know, and we're kind of a bionic ant making our way through the giants, you know.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, right? You know? They're huge, huge companies. Yeah.
And we were the first little brown bag to make our way there. And now we're taking a lot of room. And they're just imitating our product now.
Right.
You know?
No, because most of the cereal industry, they grew up. They grew during a time when they, you know, you used to have, I guess, in the 1800s or early 1900s, cereal was just grains and things like that. And then they started realizing, wow, if we put sugar in this, every kid in the world is going to want, and they produce these crappy products now, very processed, even the ones that seem like they're right.
Yeah. Like all bran, it's full of sugar, but all everybody thinks it's like a pure, you know, pure raisin product. But you see, like, now I have, you know, and to be honest, I have some Kellogg's in my pantry, but you know what? My kids, they're like, one's turning 4 and then 6 and 8. Okay. And they're asking to eat mommy's cereal every day. They're asking for it. They could eat the Cheerios. There's the other stuff in my pantry and they're asking for mommy's cereal. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah. You know, you know why though? You're developing their palate a certain way that they like, and they want to try those things. My wife is very much like that. She's a cook. She likes fresh, clean eating. My kids, since little, we never had, you know, Burger King, or I shouldn't use the name, but we never had fast food or any of that junk. And my kids don't like it. They want to eat, you know, fresh, you know, foods that have flavor, but not because it's loaded with butter, sugar, things like that. And that's something that people don't, I think that they don't realize they can develop in their children just by having it in their home or living that way. As opposed to saying, oh, I'm really busy, mom, let's stop at Burger King and get a burger and a fries for the kid, or chicken fingers. Well, at least it's chicken. We know what goes into that kind of stuff. So I think that's because of what you're doing, why your children want to eat that. I don't think it's magic. I think it's the world in which you're raising them.
I also put chocolate in it. Mitch. Just by okay. the way, I put well, chocolate in it. Yeah, it does. But they're little yeah. piece of organic fair trade chocolate.
Right. And they're not all the preservatives yeah. and the crap that's yeah. in cereal.
Yeah. And they're sweetened with honey, which is also very different than all the industrials out there, because honey is a very capricious ingredient. It's expensive. And, it's very variable because, the bees, they don't always go in the same areas and right. the prices, and there's bees that are missing,
Yeah.
Because there's less
crazy industry. I know.
Yeah, and so basically we're still using the honey when nobody else is using it anymore, And so we've kept the product, the real granola, like you make at home. And the recipe has not changed since I was making it in my kitchen. It's the same one. But now, of course, we have larger ovens. We got, a robot helping the artisans working on the floor. And there's different equipment in my facility to make things more productive, and which makes us very cost efficient. We're also not the most expensive product, because when people were telling me, I keep my bag away from my kids or my husband because they empty it too quickly.
Then they're going to eat it all.
Against the point. Yeah. I want everybody to eat it in your family, and I want you to eat it every day, not on occasion. You don't choose something that's healthy and good for you just
once
on occasion.
Right. So then like I make a special sure, occasion, treat yourself yeah, well, but other times
yeah.
don't.
Yeah. So then I managed to bring the price down and make sure that my production was able to follow this change so that the level of consumption would increase and I would be, purchased at the same level as any other cereal.
Right. So it wasn't just, that's a business goal. You want to get people using the product more. So not only do they eat healthier, but you're selling more units. So mm-hmm. from a financial standpoint, it makes sense. So let's talk about how you developed the company. So it started out as just granola, right? Artisanal granolas and I guess cereals. And now let's talk about the product line now. What does the company look like now?
Well, we got about 40 SKUs, but it's so the granola, the grand granola, which is a classic granola line, it's available in 9 flavors and it's 2 sizes. So there's a small bag, which is 300 gram, and then the family bag, which is 850 grams. And the family bag is very popular because it's a very interesting cost saving towards the small bag, But the small bag is a good entry point for the customer. And then we have grain-free granolas, which we launched in 2017, which are very high-end grain-free blends. And they're under the same personalities, if I can say it, than the grand granola. So there's a macadamia white chocolate in the classic granola, but also in the grain-free version of it.
So as people have allergies to grain and things like that, is that why they're grain-free or...?
Well, they're grain-free because it's another type of granola. It's made with seeds and nuts. And of course, they're gluten-free, but they're also delicious, and it's a different way to enjoy granola. I like to mix both of them together, the regular and the grain-free. It's not just, for people who have intolerances to gluten. It's really just to switch it up because we use our core competency to create something that was innovative and interesting. And it's more of a snacking option, I would say. And then we also have a muesli line, which is a high-end muesli line that we blend with some roasted nuts and seeds. And it's also used as an overnight porridge, this muesli. And this is our
most cereal.
Yeah, it's our most recent addition in 2020 when we launched COVID and in full COVID mode. So, it was a tough launch.
Did you have to be shut down for a while or were you still considered an essential business?
We were considered an essential business, luckily. So, we never took a break and it was a record year for us last year because
People
were eating at home and a lot of cereal consumption, even though on the other end, my food service business completely dropped off,
Yeah, because they didn't have any customers.
Yeah, exactly. So, I lost some sales at the profit of other sales, And so this, it was a good year for us, obviously. I'm not going to complain, but it was very tiring. It was tough, maneuvering through all that, sometimes you look back and even my employees look back on this time and say, everybody got a break except us, even if it was an imposed break, we never got it. I kept going to work business as usual. My employees kept going to work, it's like, it was nothing there was no relief. So there was just extra stress.
Yeah. Well, there were other people that were out of business, right? There were other people that were out of business, shut down. They didn't have that choice, but I guess people also needed you. But I think a lot of it, did you find that because you knew your business and you knew your marketing and you knew your numbers, it was easier to make a shift in the business knowing that, well, our hospitality business is going to go down. We got to get this up. Did it make it easier because you were more prepared with and more knowledgeable about your business?
Well, I mean, I'm part of this entrepreneur club and we assisted there was this presentation of like, okay, now there's a crisis going on and how you should be managing your cash flow and your money.
Oh, okay.
And we were like, you know, told how to play defensively in this context. And we didn't know that the grants were coming and that they were going to give some, you know, support.
Canada too, right? They gave you grants and okay. Same type of thing. So it was almost like a mastermind mentoring group, right?
Yeah. And it was just like, it's a first, right? Nobody's been through a pandemic that's alive today. But at the same time, they give good advice in terms of how to make sure that you have what you need to be able to get through this with all the uncertainty that was associated with the period, you know?
Right. Yeah. There's a lot to be said for that. I'm sure a lot of people didn't have those resources and, you know, and you're doing it kind of blindly, right? Yeah. At that point, you didn't know how long this would last. I think when it first started, I was sitting on my couch in my pajamas and I was thinking, well, 3 weeks, I mean, we'll be back to work and I don't have to get, and then I realized, oh my God, I better set up an office in my house and put on a shirt and wash my face, go on Zoom and start connecting with the world because, you know, people are going to think you died during the pandemic and what happened to Mitch? So I think it became very evident that this was going to go on for a while. And being in your business, you didn't know what was going to happen in terms of food. You know, people still need food, right? They had to buy it, but it was going to be a bit of a shift. But there's also snacks on your website too, or is that really the granola, but just as a snack?
We have the trail mixes. We do very gourmet trail mixes with sulfite free, you know, strawberries, cherries, blueberries, you know, nothing we do is just basic, straightforward. It's been done before. We like to always put extra, you know, value, extra care, you know, extra flavor. We want to be very gourmet and always.
That's the artisanal side of it, though, right?
I mean, and the artistic, I would have to say, you know, the very gourmet, artistic, you know, there's nothing ordinary that comes out of my plant. I mean, we roast the coconut,
yourself
pieces. Yeah. And we salt them. And we double roast the almonds and we caramelize the pecans with maple syrup. You know, there's so much love and effort in everything that we do. So you can't just like, you know, come and copy us. You can try to do the same thing, but we like to consider ourselves, in French, it's inimitable. Like there's no way to imitate us, you know?
Yeah. Right. They can learn from you, but they can't steal from you. So you're buying most of your ingredients raw, right? I mean, the nuts are raw. Everything's raw. You're toasting it there. You're dealing with it. Wow, that's really great. So we had talked about, if anybody's listening, so this episode will probably come out in maybe a month and a half, so maybe early December. So hopefully, because I know you were having some website problems with the US side. So I don't know if today I can order your product because I want to after this talk. I'm very hungry now. But you're working on that, right? So hopefully by then the link will be in the show notes. People can go to the website because you can't buy it in the States yet. But you can buy it online through you guys.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. So that's your promise to me, right? You'll get the website up and running and working.
Yeah. No, I'm on it right after this call.
Okay. So I know we've been on almost an hour. I can't thank you enough because not only is your business really interesting and exciting, and I'm going to watch you and follow your growth and all that stuff, but you have so much to offer to the people listening based on your experience. I mean, you're doing it all the right way. In an industry where you really didn't know a lot about, except you liked it and you figured it out and you're, it's like you said, you got to figure it out every day, right? Every day is a new challenge and there's something you got to do. But when you're prepared and you're good at all the planning that you do, it does get a little bit easier, right? I mean, when you deal with another issue that comes up or there's another opportunity, you get better at seeing these things and dealing with them along the way. And there's a lot to be said for that. So I thank you very much for sharing.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to my story. And let me tell you, 20 years later, I did achieve my objectives.
Yeah.
I got three kids, a well-balanced life, and I do, you know, make the money that I wanted to be able to make. So that for me is huge.
Right.
And I'm already successful in terms of my opinion and my judgment and my, you know, looking back on it, I consider myself as, you know, having succeeded in what I set out to do, you know, so it's not like I'm not in a rat race anymore,
right.
You know, I'm
content. Yeah, well, people can get to the other side of the fence if you just keep doing it the right way. All right. So before we go off, and I thank you very much, is there anything that's in the hopper that's coming that you're working on, a new line, product line or anything like that, that we should know about? It's a secret, like inside. This is like when you used to make the food in your apartment once a month is secret. So is there anything we can share that might be coming that's in R&D, so to speak?
Yeah, well, we're coming out with a really refined branding.
Okay.
That's going to go on our packaging. And it's going to be, I can tell you now, it's going to be just La Fourmi. So we wanted to simplify the name, which is a mouthful to most Anglophones. And so it's just going to be La Fourmi. And that's what people call us. It's like our nickname, you know, and so everybody calls us La Fourmi. So we're just going to be called La Fourmi, and it's going to be okay. A really sleek branding. And we're coming out with a really artistic, beautiful new packaging for the Grand Granola line.
Uh-huh.
And we've been working on that since spring. And, you know, it's hopefully going to come out early 2022, but it's going to be like really for us groundbreaking in terms of how we innovate our brand image. And we're hoping to elevate the product and really showcase the value of what we put in our products with this new branding. So that's something that's important for us. And that's going to be a really important milestone, especially for venturing into new territories.
Sure. And can people follow you on social media? Do you have a Facebook,
everything.
Instagram, the whole thing,
yeah.
Right?
You are very active on Facebook and, you know, bilingual publications, and same thing sure. with Instagram, LinkedIn, very active there if people want to link up with me. We update our website constantly. And I have an entrepreneurial blog on my website where I give pretty much my 2 cents and I share my opinion about topics related to entrepreneurships, which sometimes are off the beaten path.
Yeah. Well, it's just something you learned. I think that's great because it's always good to give back, right? To share with others that are maybe, I mean, that's the whole purpose of the podcast, right? Hopefully people will learn from what you learned. Maybe
it's a bit of like, by the way, guys.
Right. You might want to try this, or I had this problem and I solved it this way. And okay. So we'll put links in the show notes to your LinkedIn profile, Facebook, Instagram, the blog on the website. And, we'll hopefully get some people to try out the products in the United States. We've got to get them into stores. So if anybody's listening, who's a distributor or working, reach out to Genevieve and let's get them in the United States. So I thank you very, very, very much for your time.
Thank you, Mitch.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.